The ayes to the right, 242. The noes to the left, 391.
It's the biggest political crisis in post-war British history. Theresa May's deal defeated for a second time, and by only a slightly smaller margin. Will Britain crash out without a deal? Is Brexit finished? Or will the crisis just run on and on? These are the questions we're discussing on this episode of the Another Europe is Possible podcast, with Luke Cooper, a visiting fellow at the IWM in Vienna, and Zoe Williams from The Guardian. Today we're joined by Sam Tarry, who runs the political office of Super Anti-Brexit Union, the TSSA. To feedback to us on this week's podcast, you can get us on Twitter at @another_Europe, or you can get us on Facebook.com/AnotherEuropeIsPossible. Hope you enjoy it.
Welcome, Sam.
Hi.
So do you want to tell us what happened this week? Because it's really confusing.
It is really confusing. We're sort of running out of words to really describe each day that's happening in Parliament. You know, people have said it's dramatic, historic, groundbreaking, unprecedented. Clearly, Theresa May has had that, again, huge defeat. I think, actually, I must say, probably worse than she was expecting, you know, 149 votes, I think it was. But it looks like she is going to come back for another bite at the cherry. Yesterday, I think there were some more important developments. You know, Parliament itself was very, very clear that it wants no deal taken off the table. That was one, if you want.
But that wasn't binding, was it?
No, that's not legally binding. And that is, you know, the problem with all of this stuff. You know, legislation, and I hate to agree with Jacob Rees-Mogg on this, is not passed by motion in Parliament. There's several more stages for an actual piece of legislation to come into force. However, I think it is incredibly important as a political statement and a statement to the EU that we definitely, you know, the will of the sort of House of Commons is to stop a no-deal Brexit and a crash out, because I just can't believe for one second actually that anyone in the EU also wants that as well. So we're now into a situation where Theresa May has got to ask for an extension, and the reasons for that, you know, are at the moment, I think, fairly sort of unclear in terms of the actual technical reason that she'll base it upon, given that we're not headed to a general election or referendum at the moment. And obviously that's got to be agreed by all of the 27 other nations. Now, I'm not a great follower of some of the more sort of conspiratorial views of Brexit and so on, but it is interesting that Farage was on TV, and perhaps it was just willy waving, perhaps it was serious. You know, there's no doubt, I think he probably will have been talking to some of the more populist right wing leaders across Europe and trying to put some pressure, because it only takes one country to veto, and actually we then are out on our arses, pardon my French, next week. And so one of the things I think that needs to be really kind of like thought about are those other kind of votes that happened yesterday. Where do they leave the likelihood of the so-called kind of Kyle Wilson amendment? Where's that going to end up? I know a lot of people that want an opportunity to actually have a final say are kind of pinning a lot of hopes on that. But it's just been a really, you know, fascinating, Byzantine, confusing and wild week in politics. And I'm sure lots of commentators are just unable almost to explain the dynamics of what are really going on. And I think what would be interesting today is if we can try and unpick some of that stuff. I mean, as we're sat here right now, my understanding is the DUP are back in with the government, you know, trying to seek further legal assurances and so on. But it just sort of occurred to me sort of yesterday, thinking about all of this stuff at a time when obviously, you know, great controversy about Bloody Sunday and, you know, the sort of prosecutions that will and won't go ahead, that for a lot of folk, I think, particularly in England, just really not grasping deeply just the ramifications of all of those issues in Northern Ireland that Brexit has kind of really brought to the fore. And I think, you know, just reflecting all of that stuff, it is something which is potentially going to endanger, you know, the union, both in terms of what happens in Northern Ireland and in Scotland, I think. And so it will be incredibly fascinating to see what the DUP do, because in reality, you know, they are going to have to get in, from their point of view, genuinely concrete commitments that they feel are legally strong enough to be able to back her deal because of that situation back home on the ground in Northern Ireland.
Just to go back quickly to the actual vote. So the meaningful vote, she lost by 149. What was the amended meaningful vote, Luke?
So
do you know?
So the amended meaningful vote basically sharpened up the motion by taking no deal off the table completely. But however, as Sam said, it hasn't actually been taken off completely because it's still the default option. So I think now we're in a situation where next week, May has got to go to Brussels, the European Council meeting, and at that meeting she'll ask for two types of extension. One extension will be if her third meaningful vote has been passed, she'll ask for a short-term technical extension to get through the legislation she needs to pass to complete the Brexit process. If on the Wednesday morning she has been defeated again in the third meaningful vote to come, then she'll ask for this unspecified long-term extension. So that's her saying to the DUP and to the ERG, look, if you're really pro-Brexit, think very hard about how you vote next Wednesday, because I'm going to ask for a long extension of unspecified time. It's being talked about that it could be as much as 21 months, and there's already soundings in the European Union that they're going to take that very seriously. So she's working with Donald Tusk, who's the president of the European Council. So his job is to represent the interests of the EU27 member states. And he's going to help her basically try to get that through the British Parliament on Wednesday by saying, look, we're going to run with this. You'll get the long-term extension and use that to try to get your people into line in the British Parliament. If then you're at the situation where she gets the long-term extension, she then has to come back on the Monday morning and pass legislation that would amend and override the default position, which is the following Friday, Britain crashes out without a deal. So incredibly, you could imagine a situation where she goes through the whole process. I don't think this would happen, but say she gets the long-term extension in Brussels, then on the Monday morning, the British Parliament could say, we're not going to amend the legislation on Brexit. And then the default really would, that would be when the crisis breaks out, because Britain would be leaving without a deal on Friday. It won't happen. She would get the legislation through. But it's a big thing, that possibility.
I'm still confused.
Still confused.
Still confused. When she goes to the European Council, the idea that she needs a short extension, irrespective of what happens.
Yeah. And that's what the motion that was passed on Thursday says. Short-term extension if her deal is passed, right. Long-term extension if it's not passed. So that's sort of where we are.
It doesn't seem to me like that 21-month threat is as frightening as she thinks it will be.
I think the ERG are desperately wanting to avoid that. I think they feel that, you know, the sort of sand is slipping between their kind of fingers. You know, the prospect of Brexit is potentially becoming less, or at least the kind of Brexit they want. I still think that some of them are absolutely batting to conspire for us to crash out. There's no doubt about that. It's, you know, some of the more hardcore ones do really want us to actually be out, and that would be the kind of clean break that they want. I think that there are not necessarily all of the ERG pushing and pulling in the same directions. At the same time, they would be very against, in my view, a 21-month extension that just carries on the crisis, really, without resolution. And I guess the question I'm sort of wondering is, say it gets to a situation where we do have a longer extension, which I think is actually relatively probable, where does that leave her in terms of her leadership?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
I just cannot see her continuing for another 21 months. I mean, because we have had this week after week of these unprecedented historic crises in Parliament, you know, it's almost difficult to step back from it. But I think we should just do that for a second and look at the fact that, you know, you've had ministers, senior ministers, cabinet ministers not resigning, voting against the whip. You've had whips whipping one way, but then themselves government is voting a different way. This is genuinely totally unprecedented. The government is not governing, it's not functioning. You've got a situation where the shadow cabinet and the leader of the Labour Party made a decision that they would actually ask junior shadow ministers who were going to vote the wrong way to resign. And so you've got this really volatile situation in Parliament, which does make it all very, very unpredictable. But my sense is that I think the ERG would rather almost bring Theresa May down than actually have 21 months more of the kind of ongoing kind of Brexit.
But it doesn't seem like... You raised that because we like the... What happens with the Tory leadership is the really key thing.
Well, that's one key thing, but it doesn't seem like they've got much to play with, actually, because they've either got squeaking the deal through and avoiding the long delay, or they've got refusing to squeak the deal through and then having a long delay, but they haven't got an option there of bringing her down and not having a delay.
No, but they do once the 12 months over. So if you're Steve Baker and you're playing the long game, Theresa May is safe for 12 months.
Mm-hmm.
Those Tory MPs that backed her, knowing that it was very likely if they have a leadership contest, the ERG take over the Tory party, like, she's in this weird, curious position because she doesn't have support from the parliamentary Tory party. However, the parliamentary Tory party know that the mad people take over the moment she's gone. So as long as that's the case, she kind of does have their support. But if you were the ERG, then I would say your game is, if you get long extension, you try to get rid of Theresa May, change the Prime Minister, and then go for a hard Brexit once you've won the PM. And you could still do that in the context of passing her deal as well, of course. I think the prospect of her deal getting passed is pretty high.
Do you?
But the big but is that she doesn't need that many rebels. So say you've got 7 or 8 Remain Tory rebels who can probably be banked for voting against. If you add to that another 20 hard Brexit fanatics, then she's lost the vote even narrowly.
Yeah.
So I think it is still really hard for her to get it through.
And that's even without factoring in Labour MPs, not just the usual kind of suspects, you know, kind of Graham Stringer, Kate Hoey, etc., etc. You know, yesterday, obviously, we saw sort of Gareth Snell and Ruth Smeave and a few others, you know, Stephanie Peacock, voting against the Labour whip. I think that there's potentially a slightly bigger group of Labour MPs who are waiting for the moment to jump into bed with the Tories and to help deliver Theresa May's deal. And I think that will become quite apparent next week. And that, in my view, that will be what clinches it for Theresa May.
So what do you think the chances are of the deal just squeaking through?
I think they're fairly high, actually.
Really?
I mean, it is a tightrope. And of course, we've just been discussing it could fall off one way or the other. But she might just make it to the other end of that tightrope.
I think that's very interesting. So you think that there would, and we should say, and this is a bit unfortunate if we're being pessimistic, but, you know, Sam, as the political officer of the TSSA, you spend a lot of time in Parliament talking to MPs, lobbying them, and your sense is that 20... What do you have a number, or 20 or 30 might peel off?
Probably need to do a sort of number crunching, because obviously some have kind of, you know, we've had them in the right place and then they've moved and then obviously, but I do think yesterday was indicative, and I think that there are probably some others that would follow suit, but, you know, they've not wanted, for obvious reasons, you know, they're Labour MPs potentially delivering what is a Tory Brexit, that the leader of the Labour Party, you know, everyone's misgivings and sort of, you know, accusations about their position on Brexit, has said from the very beginning consistently is a disaster and is, you know, trying to mobilise Labour to oppose in Parliament. I think that would be one of the few ways that she could actually get it through. I do not think that she will get enough of the ERG to fold. I think she'll get some of them. But I still think that there will be a group of Labour MPs in some Leave areas that will just be enough to get her over the line. And I think they're keeping their powder dry and playing the game until the last moment, and then they will come out and vote for it, I'm afraid to say.
Well, there's a campaigning point there. So within the next 3 or 4 days, listeners, write to your MPs, especially if you live in a Leave voting area, and ask them to vote against the deal. And so far, the unity of the Labour side against Theresa May's deal has been pretty strong. So there must be a ray of light there that the Labour vote will hold up, potentially on a following the whip basis, not on a I'm a pro-Remainer basis, but on a kind of Labour unity basis. Is that possible?
Yeah, I think so, because I think, you know, people who are kind of concerned about the fortunes of the Labour Party surely need to factor in that if it is Labour MPs that then get Theresa May over the line, and it's above and beyond like the really kind of hardcore kind of Brexiteer types that have always been on that side and have all campaigned, you know, to get out of the European Union anyway, that there will be a political price to pay surely for those MPs, because obviously the vast majority of, you know, the Labour Party don't want that to happen. There's very few trade unions that are supporting, or none in fact, Theresa May's deal. You know, the TUC's completely condemned it in terms of worthless commitments around workers' rights and so on. So those people will be very, very isolated, I think, from the wider kind of Labour family at that point.
Where do you think this leaves the Corbyn strategy? And I think that there are two parts to that question. One part is the more general part of the transformative programme that Labour Party has. So where does it kind of leave that? But then the other part of it that I'd be quite interested to see your thoughts is that what is the Corbyn strategy, as in the individual Corbyn and his team? What is their strategy in this situation? What are they trying to do? Because I think whatever perspective you take in the debate, it's fair to say it's not always clear what the thinking is.
I think that's because there are competing strategies, if truth be told. I think that there are those that feel that if we as a party stand in the way of Brexit, ultimately that there'll be a heavy political price to pay in, you know, leave voting Labour held seats. At the same time, there are those that say, yeah, and by the way, that's why the focus has been so very much on kind of having a general election to kind of like reset the dial. And obviously there are those that genuinely think it should be put back to the people for a final say. Because for me, it all comes back to, ultimately, what do Labour want to do? We want to win a general election. What did Corbyn want? He doesn't want a referendum, really. He wants a general election, okay? Because I think he genuinely does believe that he can win a general election, right? But all of those things are obviously completely interlinked. And so the discussions that we as TSSA have been having with, you know, his team and, you know, senior shadow cabinet people are very much on the basis that if their argument is that once we get beyond Brexit, it will be beneficial for Labour because we can get back to talking about more bread and butter issues where Labour's policies are popular, where Corbyn is very strong, you know, whether that be NHS, education, you know, sort of jobs, investment, etc., etc. The difficulty with that strategy, and this is the conversation we've had with them, is that the polling that we've got, and, you know, this is serious stuff, MRP, 33,000 people, done at significantly different times across the course of over 14 months, you know, mapping, you know, communities and particularly focusing on, you know, sort of Labour leave voters as well, shows that actually that electoral strategy is potentially fundamentally flawed. And I think, you know, for your listeners, you need to be thinking about, okay, who did Labour get to vote for us in 2017? And how do you hold that coalition together and build on it? Because for me, that is what all of this, in terms of Jeremy's team and his strategy, comes down to, and two competing views as to it. So some of the people that are advising Jeremy think that because there are far more seats, it's not actually far more, but there are a significant proportion of seats which we need to win in terms of an offensive campaign, i.e. target seats that we don't currently hold or ones maybe we need to win back, that enough of them are leave voting seats that if we are seen to be too pro-referendum, to be too anti-Brexit, then we go backwards in those and we don't win them. However, our counter-argument to that and the research and the evidence we've got shows that the opposite is actually true, and I'll just explain that. So what it says is that in those Labour leave seats, the Labour voters themselves have now, not in every case, but in many cases, shifted significantly more against Brexit maybe not necessarily to be a majority, but certainly in quite a few seats it's now a majority against Brexit. And you have to also factor in that some of the MPs who are talking about these so-called sort of northern heartland seats in quite pastiched ways, in my view, are not also factoring in that, yes, you've got a proportion of the Labour vote that did vote to leave, but you've also got nearly all of the Conservative and all of the UKIP vote that did vote to leave. And so therefore your whole electorate, the Labour people, are the ones where the shift has happened the most, both in terms of being most concerned about Brexit in terms of economic impact, but also just about, you know, it not being the thing that they're going to go out and vote on. The flip of that is the fact that in many seats that we won in 2017 and many other targets that had coalitions of voters that included lots of young people, that probably pulled in people from Greens, Lib Dems, even some Remain voting Tories, I think, in some seats, is that those coalitions are far more volatile, because the kind of Labour Leave classic voter is actually very much more tribally and culturally Labour and has been for a long time. We picked it up an awful lot of people at the last election who hadn't voted Labour either in a long time or were voting Labour for the first time, particularly amongst kind of young voters. And so the question we need to ask ourselves is, well, you know, are we realistically saying that our strategy is based upon winning more Leave voters, which would mean winning more Tory Leave voters in constituencies in the Midlands, Yorkshire and the North East? I just personally think there's more chance of it staying on the sun than that happening. Mm-hmm. Because you also then go to Scotland, where out of the top 20 target seats, you know, nearly half are in Scotland. And, you know, fundamentally and clearly in Scotland, the electorate is in a totally different place on Brexit. So we're almost saying that if that is our strategy to win back these kind of descriptively pastiched kind of northern heartlands for Labour, then we basically, in my view, throw away our opportunity to win in Scotland. I think we put seats at risk. We wouldn't win Norwich North, we'd lose Norwich South. I think that, you know, some of the seats on the south coast we also would lose. And that's even before you get to London. No chance that you'll win Wimbledon, no chance that you'll win Putney. You'll probably lose a number of the North London seats as well. And, you know, and across the country, when you add all of the different ones up, having a much more anti-Brexit position is electorally far, far more beneficial than actually being seen to deliver Brexit. And I think that there is a fundamental miscalculation in how we grow and build and hold together our electoral coalition. And so for me, that is the kind of debate that is going on amongst the top brass within the Labour Party.
And how receptive have they been to that research that you did and those arguments that you make then? Because it feels like a load of competing strategies are being undertaken at the same time, which is why it looks like nothing's happening.
Well, of course, look, you know, the sort of strategic ambiguity thing was always to, you know, which I think was right, by the way, for 2017, was to kind of be all things to all people, you know, so you are more Brexity in the places you need to be, that you're more Remainy in other places. But that is clearly hurting us, because the thing about Jeremy and the thing about his success, both in terms of winning leadership contests and then obviously that big result in the general election, was that his USP was that, whether you agree with everything he stands for or not, is he was a politician who said it as he sees it, spoke truth to power, you know, the honest politics. And the problem is, it's very difficult to keep that USP and be seen as the kind of honest politician who say things as they see them if you're having to duck and weave and, you know, be opaque about our position, because actually we are trying to ride these two horses. And if you look at Corbyn's personal poll ratings, you know, he's been really badly hit, I think, because of that. Now, there's a very strong argument to say, of course, you know, once the opportunity of a general election arises, he'll get to present himself, but he will not be able to present himself in such a fresh way, as because he was essentially unknown at the last general election to many people and many voters. That won't happen. He is being defined at the moment, and I think that is another kind of like danger. And so we've said, you know, privately to the key kind of decision makers, look, even if your strategy, which we disagree with, is to essentially for some kind of soft Brexit to be the ultimate end point, because you believe that that electorally is the best kind of bet for Labour, you need to take the 75% of your own voters who are against Brexit with you. Otherwise, you're going to be in real, real trouble. And these often are the voters that are more mobile in terms of their voting habits and more volatile. that clearly did impact, because there were, you know, those big statements, you know, from Keir, from Emily, from John McDonnell around the referendum. There was a lot of kind of like noise. But as I said at the time, you know, there was then a counterpunch, and that counterpunch is still happening.
Right, right, right. That's the way I perceive it from the outside, is that we've been in the counterpunch phase for 6 weeks, maybe.
Yeah, potentially. But I think also the Labour Party genuinely don't have any more control over events in Parliament than Theresa May does, I'm afraid to say. I mean, it was absurd that, you know, some commentators were trying to have a go at Labour yesterday on the sort of stuff around a referendum, when clearly tactically, and this is, I think, one of the problems that, you know, people need to kind of be thinking about, is that there is definitely no majority of MPs who want a referendum, and there needs to be a game changer to get enough of those MPs to change their mind. And that is why people like Ruth Smith and Gareth Snell and others, and we're hearing that, you know, maybe next week in some of the votes, people like Lisa Landy will actually break ranks to vote with the government, is because they just desperately do not want a referendum under any circumstances.
The Kyle Wilson Amendment puts forward a ratification referendum idea. So basically, you vote with the government on the condition that the people then get to say yes to her deal or no, let's stay in the EU. The key problems with it were, first, that choice, and this is what your nandies are really anti. There are perfectly decent arguments that giving people a choice between Theresa May's deal, which nobody wants, and staying in the EU, which didn't win the referendum, is not an honourable choice. I mean, I'd have a problem with it, because I think the dishonourable thing would be putting a constitutionally damaging thing on the ballot, but parking what I think, there are people who think that's just dishonourable.
So you've got to have no deal on the ballot paper in some form.
Yeah, basically, argument, you have to have no deal, or you have to have a kind of go back to the drawing board. The other problem with it, which I think MPs are still struggling with, is it does require them to go and vote with the government and get Theresa May's deals through.
But Labour will whip in favour of some version of the Kyle Wilson Amendment, right, Sam?
I can't really see any other alternative.
Yeah.
You know, I think that is genuinely something that can both hold the party together, command the kind of biggest amount of support. It can also get support from a number of different trade unions. And, you know, if you think about this as well, for you know, your listeners may not be so well versed in different actors beyond just Jeremy's kind of inner circle and so on. You know, you have to think that, say, for example, the GMB, whose position is not necessarily to oppose Brexit, but is very strongly to say that any deal should be put back to the people in a final say, they have a very strong and large group of MPs, you know, in the GMB group who they will exert a degree of influence over, particularly on this issue, because ultimately they are representing hundreds of thousands of workers in those MPs' constituencies. And so I think there are a number of kind of like actors in this situation. And I know that the GMB, and particularly Tim Roach, is the General Secretary of the GMB, is very, very, very keen on the Kyle Wilson Amendment as a sort of sensible way forward.
I know that Keir thinks it's the only way forward. You guys think it's the only way forward, is that right?
There really aren't any other options. I mean, look, TSSA might come out and say, look, actually, we'd rather just revoke Article 50, the whole damn thing. But I mean, that is not my advice to the TSSA, because I think there are some democratic implications for that that mean that we can't get around having another referendum, as much as people don't want that. Therefore, it is the most obvious way forward. But it's going to be tough, I think.
And it'll be tough to get it without resignations from the Tory government. I mean, it will be hard to get it through. But I think for me, the game changer in the last week or so is this idea of long extension. It's very plausible from the British side that Theresa May would want it for the reasons we've discussed. And it's plausible from the European side, because it allows them to park this difficult discussion, and it avoids cliff edge Brexit. And they can maintain their negotiating position on the withdrawal treaty, but they could also say, look, we're happy to spend 21 months talking about a future trade deal if you want to, and starting to scope that out. So you can see that there's different alignment of groups. And politically, the strongest part of it for me is the further away you get in time from the 2016 referendum, the less strength the will of the people discourse has in this situation. You know, it was the will of the people 5 years ago, 10 years ago. Was it the will of the people in 1975? You know, you've just got to get further away from that in time and get to a space. And just demographically, the longer this goes on, the better position remains to win.
That is classic Are You Dead Yet politics.
Well, maybe I should put it more positively, in the sense that, well, you could do nice things. You could have, we should push for a citizens' assembly in the 21-month break.
Yeah,
I can't imagine Theresa May's government running a citizens' assembly very effectively, though.
Thanks to our guests, and thanks again for listening. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a rating or review on your podcast platform. We'll be back very soon. See you then.